Hi, everybody. It's Jean Nathan. This is Crosstown Conversations with news about New Orleans that counts, about our economy, our environment, our culture, and some occasional politics. Thank you for joining and enjoy the show. Chuck Perkins, there's a thing called poets, and there's a thing called spoken word art. You do spoken word art, but you are by nature, I think you would have to call you a poet. So distinguish for me between the two. This is Poetry Month. We want to celebrate it. I can't think of anybody I'd rather celebrate poetry with than you. So I want to understand the difference between the two and how your talents as a poet and your talents as a spoken word artist, not to mention a musician and a club owner, intermingle and how they influence each other. But let's start with the spoken word art and your poetry.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've always considered myself a poet, but I think what we've been seeing a lot of lately, especially a lot of what I've done, has in fact been probably would skew more to the spoken word side. And I think the spoken word is performative, right? And so, you know, it's something that you're going to do in front of an audience, and you know, it has to be alive and it has to move people. Whereas sometimes just a poet might use more of an economy of words, and maybe, you know, you could do it in front of 100 people and it might make people think, but maybe it doesn't get them like really moving like a Sunday preacher might. So that's my humble opinion, but I think because it's relatively new, I don't know that you can go in a dictionary and find like a definitive answer on what is what. But I've always wanted to be a poet, and one of the other biggest differences is that, you know, some of the performative stuff, I mean, it sounds great and it feels good. But like if you had to just read it, it comes across a little differently. You know, it has a different kind of punch if you have to read it on the page. And, you know, whereas some of the poetry, I think, is, you know, a lot more, it can tend to be a lot more thoughtful and, you know, can have, I think, in the end, a lot more meat on the bones, if you ask me.
So, I've always loved poetry, but felt as if it was some kind of alien language that if you kind of sat back in your seat and relaxed and let the words flow for you, it would be comfortable. You could understand it and really enjoy it. But you really kind of have to not You have to be sure that you're not intimidated by it, because it's so different from what you're used to in terms of prose, in terms of, you know, a straight sentence.
I was reading a collection of writings by Oscar Wilde, and he was talking about the poets who were writing in his time, I guess in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And he kind of called them out because he referred their work to he made a reference of it being like a word puzzle that was just difficult for people to understand. And he challenged the poets to do better, that it doesn't have to be that way, that you could communicate to people in a way that where they could understand it, where, you know, and possibly even learn something from what it is you have to offer as a poet. And I found that interesting because sometimes, you know, we think about stuff that may have been done like in the 1800s and feel like maybe it was done in a better way. But Oscar Wilde was saying, no, it doesn't have to be this difficult word puzzle for people. You know, you could offer them something that's accessible to them.
So there's a poet named E.E. Cummings. I think that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Who I really liked in my student days, and I found him easy to understand because we kind of in some way spoke the same language.
Got it.
That I think that the thing about poetry is that each poet has a different language. It's not, again, when you're dealing with prose, it's all the same. It may have a different tone. It may have different meaning. It may have different phrasing, all kinds of things that made it different. But it was basically straight poetry. I think straight prose. I think with poetry, it really does have a special characteristic that you either are simpatico with or not. Do you
probably right. And I didn't think about this until you just said what you said, but it's almost like comedy, you know, like you go to a comedy show and if a comedian makes a certain reference, it's kind of like based in a certain understanding of something. And if you understand that thing, then you'll get the humor in it, right? But if he makes this reference and you have no idea what the hell he's talking about, then you probably won't laugh because, you know, you can't follow it. You know what I mean? And so I guess you're right. It is the same. It can be the same thing with poetry as well. There's certain people speak a certain language who touch on certain topics. And it's like, you have clarity, you know exactly what it is they're saying, but sometimes somebody can go in a direction and he's just talking about stuff that you're just not familiar with and probably be a lot more difficult for you to even be able to appreciate what's being said if you can't follow it, you know?
So when you do spoken word, the thing I find about your style and impact is that it's pretty vibrant. It is not soft. It is not harsh, but it is strong.
Mm-hmm.
And you speak, I'm not going to say loud, but you are not soft. So when I read E.E. Cummings, that's pretty soft stuff.
It
doesn't mean that it's soft in its underlying meaning. It's just mm-hmm. the delivery of the words and the speaker would be soft. So tell me how you developed your delivery.
You know, that's a difficult one, Gene. It's like I remember as a kid, somebody asked Michael Jackson, it was something about him dancing, you know, and his response was just really, it's not something that he planned out. It kind of came from him. And in some ways, it's the same thing. I think I've been around long enough. Like when I hear my voice, I just hear like a regular voice. But, you know, people have always said, man, you have like a really, you have a great voice. I remember once I was in Los Angeles just bringing some clothes to the cleaners. And a dude standing right next to me is like, you should be in commercials. Like that. You know? So I guess, like, if you got a voice that has a pleasing sound, or if there are people who might find it pleasing, it's not something you really work at. It's like you either have it or you don't. And I know some people who got some voices that to me sound like the fingernails going down the chalkboard. The poem might be great, but it's like, you know, you got to get past the voice before you can even like hear the poem. You know what I mean? If they are performing it.
I can't help but look at the words on your t-shirt, Nola by Nature, And that kind of resonates for me in terms of what you're saying, in terms of the naturalness of what you do, of your delivery. But Chuck, when you did when you worked with us on the performance about the Ninth Ward and how they dealt with Katrina and came out of it, that was powerful stuff. And I really feel that if you were not the speaker who was delivering the words, it have had by far the strength that it had as a result of your actually delivering the words. So you can't belittle how I think it's not just the words, but and the delivery, but kind of the combination that results in that results in an impact that would not have happened if you didn't have those two things working. How would you describe, if there is a way to describe poetry that emanates, poetry or spoken word that emanates from New Orleans as distinct from other places? What is it about our words and in fact our songs? And
I
we
think
just lost Frogman Henry, and that was a delivery that nobody could forget. That was a part of our lives.
I don't know that the poetry of New Orleans differs that much. I think that when you look at the palette that the poets from New Orleans that they get to work with, like some of the images, the ideas they get to express, all of that stuff is uniquely New Orleans. But we live in this global village right now, and you got social media, you got the internet. And one of the things I actually, I think it's problematic for creatives all across the country, is that if there's somebody who come up with like this just awesome style or awesome delivery, and the stuff is framed a certain way, it at this point, unfortunately, it doesn't matter where he is. If that person is in New York or Los Angeles or Kansas City, and he put it on, and he could put it on Facebook where people can access it, in some ways, that'll be the thing that'll probably have even more of an influence on like up and coming poets. And I find that problematic, but I think that's where we are right now.
Do you have a favorite poet?
I love Robert Hayden. I like Charles Bukowski. But my favorite poet is a singer, Gil Scott-Heron. I love him, and I think it is because he has a good mix of poetry and politics. His political perspective that's always about just telling the truth and uplifting people, and talking about those human I guess elements that could I guess bring us all down if we're not careful, and he does it in a very honest way. And I'm a big Gil Scott fan. In fact, I had a CD that came out in 2012, and a guy from London, when he reviewed that CD, I was surprised. He said, "Whoever Chuck Perkins is, this guy is the spiritual offspring of Gil Scott-Heron." So for me,
Oh, you just gave me chills.
that was a big, big honor. And because Gil Scott is a guy I'd listened to almost several times a week, for like the last 20, 25 years.
How do you see our, let's call it our vocal culture? I just made that up. A combination of, again, our poetry, spoken word, songs, music. How do you see it evolving? One of the things that has me concerned is that I feel like I've lost contact with the most current forms of our culture, our performing culture. There was a time when I knew all the musicians out there and I went to all their performances, and you get a little bit older and you're not out on the streets as much. And And I have a tendency to not feel like I can see what's new and how the music is changing. And so it begins to sound redundant to me a little bit. I'll hear some music and I'll say, oh my God, that's just really kind of second generation. I don't know, Johnny Vodakovich or Alvin Batiste, the Neville Brothers. There's a lot of fake, no, and I shouldn't say fake, but there's a lot of second generation Neville Brothers out there. Where do you see the trends in our music and our songs and our spoken word?
Being that I'm so close to it and that I'm really like in it, it's difficult to say. And because I got the club, I mean, I get a chance to hear poets and rappers and funk bands and jazz musicians. The good news is there are some young lines out there that are coming up that, are that have a lot to offer, a lot to bring to the table. I'm going to close with a poem.
There we go.
Okay, it's called Rain. It's called Rain. Some men pray for rain while others beg it to stop. The witch doctor danced for rain, a cry to God to feed the crop. The fool risks his life to make it rain, a cry to God to feed his ego. The body requires water. Hubrists build golf courses in the desert. It is a matter of life for the living. The rain has cursed the desert and blessed the jungle. Happy people dance in it as sacred. Pessimists feel sorrow as an omen. The rain doesn't fall on one man's house, but it can fall on one man's heart. There's chemistry between the sun and rain. The relationship is steamy. In the mind of one, the rain has ruined everything, while for others, it has cleansed the land. Which side of the window do you view the storm? The gods can't sleep.
We just lost you. I think we just lost you with literally the last word of your poem. And I'm going to find a way to capture that and add it to what we just did. But that was beautiful. That is we often think about that when they talk about the rain. Okay, folks, it's all going to be great. It's not going to be rain. I said, what do you mean it's called break? We need the rain. So it is that tension between what some need and what others want. So you're great. We're going to have you back. We'll finish up and we'll do some more. And Jean will learn how to do her Zooms better. Okay. On to the next chapter. Thank you. Grand Vacher is an artist who's, I've watched his work really evolve, where the connections are clear between the original base of trees that were fairly easy to read as the roots and base of trees, to work that is swirling patterns that are made in a sense with elements of trees, but no longer look like trees. And I think that that evolution from being more representative to being more abstract is always fascinating. That it's not an easy thing to do. People probably think, oh, okay, that's abstract. Okay, that was representational, and so be it. But that transition is not an easy one, I don't think.
No,
So
it's not.
I'm curious how that happened with you.
Yeah. Well, I think to say pretty easily and pretty straightforward, the transition has been one from the physical to basically thinking through, I could use the word metaphysical, and
Oh.
that it's going from what we actually see to what we actually feel and understand. And so I was actually imitating what I saw in my early days from my undergraduate years on, and in my early days as a developing artist, to actually be working through photorealism, literally
Huh.
taking photographs and then painting what I saw in photographs, to
Wow. I didn't know that.
basically going back and understanding why was I doing what I was doing. What was the rationale? What was the reason? What was I trying to accomplish? And so, in that quest for understanding, is where I started to understand that I was not necessarily looking for what I saw, but what I was feeling and what I was thinking and what I was trying to understand in this world. And so, I guess I was able to understand the forms that I was painting for so many years and drawing for so many years, that now those have become part of my understanding of my world and my understanding of what I'm trying to figure out in this world that I'm in. And so now these things are completely improvisational. There's nothing in it that I get from looking at. I still draw from life. I still go out and walk in the primarily city park. I love to go to Jean Lafitte State Park because it's so close and it's so involved in for me answering questions about our existence. And so that's part of why I make these things, and I'm trying to understand, what is this thing about, whole idea about the natural world. What does that mean? What does natural mean? So that's the questions that I try and answer for myself primarily, but hopefully for other people who are as curious as I am about, what I see and what I believe. So the belief system always comes into it as well, and has been developing based on those experiences and those experiences that I have within the work itself. So there's a lot that we can answer from a very straightforward place, but also to a very deep quest for understanding and understanding who I am and my existence in this world.
Well, I think to examine yourself and your relationship with the world through nature and through your experiences with it just makes all the sense in the world, because often we forget that everything else around us are living creatures like us.
Exactly.
We forget about that connection, that it a tree may have a trunk and roots in the ground, and we may have two legs that we walk around on, but ultimately, we're both trying to survive, against challenges and take advantage of resources, whether they're in the ground or in the air or, you know, at the, in the store that we go to shop. So understanding how we treat what we have to work with as important, and revere that opportunity to work with those things, I think is important. That's what you're talking about, in a way. Yeah,
absolutely. And how we exist, you know, with each other becomes important for me in thinking through this process. You know, I love to work with people, but, you know, in order to work with people, I have to understand myself. And I can't do anything for anybody if I don't know what I'm doing for me. And so I understand who I am. And so that's a really big important part. And so these experiences in my studio have really helped me through this existence of who I am. And so I also like to, you know, tell stories that people don't see and don't understand when they first see what I do, and that's fine. There are some people who kind of clue into, you know, some of the stories that they see. I am very enamored by stories about the natural world and stories about, you know, trees particularly. I'd love to talk about, you know, the experience of thinking through, let's put it that way, the baobab tree. The mythology in Africa about West Africa, about the baobab tree. If it were not for the baobab tree and its roots holding the world together, it would fall apart. Mm. And so, you know, those kinds of things I love to think through and try and find a deeper meaning in. What does that mean? And why is the iroko tree such an important tree? And for us, you know, some ideas about mulberries and things like that that go through our cultural history. So, you know, those things are deep within the stories that I tell within the drawings and the paintings that I do.
How did, when you first started working with the tree as a core form in your work, was there a spark for that? Was there a moment that it turned that light on?
I think, you know, what turned the light on for me was, you know, I'm a city boy. I was born and raised in a city. My grandfather was a big influence on my life, my maternal grandfather. And he would take us crabbing and so on. And we would have to go, you know, outside of the city to do those kinds of things. And we learned about what it was you had to do in order to do that. And I got to be involved in looking at and observing all of these things that were happening around me, and the beauty of it, you know, just enamored me. At one point, the City Parkways Park Commission, mm-hmm. had their property now where Mount Olivet Cemetery is, and they would grow trees there, and I would spend a lot of time in those trees. As a kid, I'd walk home from grammar school from St. Leo and end up in those trees and spend quite a bit of time on my way home from walking from St. Leo to our home behind on Parker Street behind Dillard. And I would, you know, spend a lot of time there in my thoughts and in my imagination and in my thinking. And so that became important for me, just the idea of being within and feeling within nature and being a part of it. And so, and I got that, you know, from those experiences with my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would be nothing for him to, you know, be driving along. And he had one eye on the road typically and one eye in the gutter because he was looking for a turtle, right? And so if he found a cowan, right, he would stop the car, open the trunk and throw the cow in the back of the trunk, right? So that was a treat for him. And so all of those kinds of things, you know, meant a great deal to me about understanding life and all the forms of life and how, you know, we move through it and we circle through it. And so that was significant for me. And so it got to be too, where I started to use and understand some of those things. One of the things that I did when I was an undergraduate that was significant for me, that's made a spark for me, was how I could use this. And so I got kind of involved in the photorealism thing, as we were talking about before. So I would take my own photographs and then paint them. I would, after one of the hurricanes, when I was at an undergraduate at UNO, had these fish that were dead and on the levee and so on. And then all the trash had kind of, from that hurricane, had kind of crumpled up onto the curb. I photographed those things and I painted them, and I thought about them. Why was I doing that? And why I was doing that was because they were beautiful forms, absolutely exquisite, the way that they gathered naturally from the wind, etc. And it was, and for everybody else, it was trash, but for me, it was just so beautiful and interesting. The shapes, the colors, the form. And I thought, you know, well, wow. You know, that's so interesting, but everybody just walks over it. And so I thought about myself and thought about me and where I came from and my people, and said, you know, that's what happens for me. People just walk over me and think that I'm nothing. You know, so I use that as a metaphor. And I got very interested in thinking about, you know, how to tell these stories using these forms. And so that kind of got me on using natural forms, the tree, things that are end up around it, as a way to tell stories.
Have you been up on the levee in Crevasse 22? And did you go up to where, you know, it's not a typical levee, right? A levee we usually think of as just a straight line, but up there it's like some kind of weird labyrinth.
Yes.
And you have to kind of circle around, go up and down. What did you think about that part of the world? And I can't stop thinking about it. And if I were an artist, I would be doing something with it. But
yeah. Well, it often, you know, reminds me. And then, you know, I have a tendency to go to the same place, and the same place is always very different. And so the same thing happens, that we take for granted some of these things, that these things are living things, that river is a living river. And so it's going to do what a river does. It's going to live, and it's going to change, and it's going to make things different. Maybe better, maybe not, but it's going to make things different. And so there's nothing wrong with difference, I think, is what I'm coming to grips with. There's something beautiful about change. And so I think that's one of the things that I really felt when I was up on the levee, was to understand, you know, that this thing is a living creature, just like us, and it's been around much longer than us, and I, you know, I always enjoy knowing that, you know, I am just a piece of a bigger puzzle. A small piece, infinitesimal small piece of a bigger puzzle. And
I hope I didn't interrupt you, but I look at the change, the short-term changes too. So there's long-term changes, but there's also the change from, say, the late summer, fall, when it's more droughty, and, you know, it hasn't been raining as much, and so it's kind of dried out. And then, you know, winter comes along, and it just kind of stabilizes in that way. But it also has willows kind of beginning to pop up as a kind of hint that something else is coming. Right. But what really captures me is how the sea level change. My husband's always correcting me, the elevation change. Okay, so there's times when, you know, it's so hollowed out that you imagine that you can see the kind of structures that are under the Mediterranean Sea, left over from Grecian and Roman times.
Oh, yeah.
And I imagine if we had something like that here, what would it be? What would it look like? And how would it affect our thinking about what's on the other side of the levee, so to speak?
That's what's wonderful about artists. They can help us to see things that we can't see. And their vision is just sharper and truer in many ways because of how they see. And so it's just a gift to have their work displayed in that beautiful natural space because they give us a whole another way of looking at it. So that's pretty exciting. And I think that, people that come to see the work also, experience that. It's like, okay, this is another way for me to look at this.
And I think the fact that they can view both the art as well as nature in close proximity, it definitely affects their thinking about the relationship between things on Earth. And so, yeah, I think that's a big part of it, is looking at that connection.
Right. And like I said, metaphor for me is what you see in my work is not always as straightforward as you may think it is, because there's a lot of things in there that are laden with obviously what I think about the world, but also too what I think other people think about the world and our existence. So that's those are parts of it too that I like the crevasse. We exist in so many different layers and levels,
Complex, very
and
complex.
so I am trying to also have you experience in my work different layers and levels. I'm hoping that there's a sense that sense of mystery that you may see in the work causes you to think a little deeper about who you are, and why is it that we do what we do, why.
Tell
Ahead.
me about your show that's opening Friday, and what you're hoping people will again see in your work.
Well, I'm very pleased to be showing in the space called Other Plans. This is the second show at Other Plans, and very pleased to be showing with Hanna Çalu. Hanna is an artist that I've respected for quite some time, and we both use elements of the landscape. She literally uses them in her work, and to actually communicate and to talk about, our understanding of the world. So what they'll see, I will have a few drawings, and my drawings in this show range from, oh gee, how big is it? 10 feet by 18 feet,
Wow.
and range in between that, all the way to some smaller drawings that are, I think there's 12 by 18 inches. And so we both have pieces on the wall and pieces that are in the space, sculptural pieces that exist with you. And so it's going to be an interesting show to experience. We are hoping that it is an experience, and that it's one that that when you leave, that you will think about it as well as come back and experience again.
Well, this is going to be quite a weekend and quite a month of art because the day after your show, of course, is Tan, Bob Tannen and Frank Gehry comparing their architectural and art notes at the Orr O'Keeffe Museum in Mississippi, opening on Saturday from 10 in the morning until 5. And then we have the shows that we're going to be showcasing at the Crevasse, which are going to open a whole new saga.
Right. We're going to be open on Sundays, starting on April 21st. And so hopefully that will enable more people to come and experience the wonderful space and the wonderful art that's there. We're looking for new work by you and new work by some of the artists that are already represented. And then every month we hope to plan events that will again, you know, point us to the importance of the environment and the importance of caring for that environment and looking at it and using it, you know, as you have, as a way to learn more about ourselves and each other. So hopefully that's what we can look forward to in the days ahead, the spring and summer Sundays at Crevasse 20.
And Cheryl really dug in at a time when I was having massive health issues, and she didn't lose a beat and kept this thing going and made sure that we're going to get this open with the wonderful artists that we have there, including you. I love you. Everybody loves your work. That's up on the wall there, and I'm so pleased that we have it, and I feel like the whole show built around it. It did, in fact, stimulate my thinking. Aside from worrying about oak trees on the routes around the city, that was a big impetus for me, is watching trees that were in bad health and not doing well and dying. But also your piece, really, I said, oh, okay, so that's where this can go. You know, it was definitely a departure, and I could see how your mind went there from where it was. And that stimulated me thinking about trying to do something more with trees. And Cheryl's been at it, and she has definitely got it going. And I think people are going to really enjoy it. Ron, I'm going to look forward to not only this, but you have a big show coming up at the CAC pretty soon too, don't you?
I hope to. This will be after Prospect.
Ways off, but still coming.
Still coming and still starting the preparations. It's a lot of needs to be done.
Tell me I'm right. Mm-hmm. Don't we have an explosion of creative artwork in this city like never before?
I agree. I think the young artist, I can say young artist now, that I see out and working, it's fantastic. The experiences that we're able to see and young folks and older folks popping up all over the place right now that I have never seen before, that I'm so happy that they're here and working so hard to express this city in such a way that we haven't had before, you know. I'm very happy to see that, and I'm also very happy to be teaching some of them still, and very pleased to say that, you know, our students, our seniors, will have a show here at Xavier pretty soon as well.
All right. Do you have a date on that yet?
Yeah, it's going to be actually April 20th. We'll have 5 of our seniors.
April is not the cruelest month. It's the most exciting art month.
Right. That's true. You're right about that. And right in the middle of Jazz Fest, they'll be showing their work. But it's exciting, though, to have the opportunity to experience with them their generation.
I hope somebody, I wish I could do it, but I've got more than I can. I've what is it? You chew off, has what's that? I'm terrible about metaphors, but I've bitten off as much as I can chew, I think. Yep. It's somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But I think talking about the music and the art,
uh-huh.
It used to be really all about the music. We did have shows of art at the fair, at the grandstands, but nothing like what's going on throughout the city now. And I think
that's true.
I agree with you. Being proud about it is the spirit.
I know it may not be the right time to shout this out, but I went to a Junebug production at the Powerhouse, Sashe Powerhouse, this past weekend with my wife. And I was so moved by the performance there of dancers and musicians that I can't tell you. It was such an inspiring experience. And it was called Soul to Soul.
Yeah.
And it was one of the more moving experiences I've had in the theater in quite some time. And so I'm looking forward to those kinds of things in the future, you know, that they just keep popping up, they keep coming. And so I'm just so happy to be here at this time.
Yeah, you need to make sure and keep us up to date and informed on what's going on. I didn't really learn about some of the recent shows coming up until the past few days. So I know there's so much out there now that you have to really keep at it. And,
And I'm
also, you know, deep in preparations for the show in Mississippi. Ron Bechet, you're one of my faves, and you've been an inspiration. And our conversation today has definitely lived up to your inspiring contribution to our creative life here. And I look forward to a lot more of it.
Well, thank you.
It's good to talk to you, Gene.
Thank you, Cheryl.
And we'll look forward to seeing you on Friday and seeing the show. For what, 2 months, looks like?
It's going to be from, I'll start open Friday with an opening reception from 5 to 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be up until June 9th.
Right. All right.
We'll get there for sure.
Okay.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with
Thank
us.
Thank you. All righty.
Take Bye-bye. Care. See you Bye-bye. Soon.
This is Jean Nathan for Crosstown Conversations. Tune in next week, too.